morning, everybody. Welcome to this summary ASAF meeting. It's so, I couldn't say unseasonably hot, but it is, has been hot for a very long time in the UK. So, gentlemen, please feel free to take your ties off because it's simply too hot for a tie. Especially when we get an educational session on financial instruments with characteristics of equity. So, Kumar, I give the floor to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Hans. Thanks for setting the scene. Okay, good morning, everybody. And as in the agenda, what we plan to cover today is the discussion paper we just published on financial instruments with characteristics of equity. Since we only published it on the 28th, I'm assuming everybody's read it cover to cover. But just in case that's not happened, we thought we would do the session. And the aim of the session is not to look for your feedback as of now. We will certainly do that. You're not going to avoid that. That's going to come. But to give you an overview of what is a DP, what does it cover, to help with your outreach, your discussion. So the whole presentation is structured in the same format as the discussion paper. And it provides an overview of the key principles with some examples, which we added and going along as we learn more as we present this. And it's for 2 hours. So you see that we have got 60 slides. So with 2 hours, I don't think we plan to cover all the slides. It's also been included in there for completeness so that it helps. And this brings me to how we plan to present this. And here's the good news. You don't have to listen to me for 2 whole hours. I won't be doing the whole thing, so I'll be starting off, and thanks to Mehdi and Sue, they have agreed to help with the presentation. So I'll start off, then hand over to Sue, and then it'll come back to me on derivatives, and finally Mehdi will close the session with looking at presentation and disclosure. Okay, with that, just can I take you all to slide 3, just to emphasize one thing, is the comment letter deadline. It's the longest, 180 days, 7th of January. I know it sounds a lot, long time, but I know given the due process and other things, there's quite a bit of work to be done. So I just wanted to highlight that. It's 7th of January 2019 when the comment letter deadline closes, and obviously we will take it forward after that as we do. Coming to the first part of what is the project scope? In scope are the classification. It's what we cover under IAS 32, debt and equity from the issuer's perspective. We are not looking at anything else like recognition and measurement or the other aspects that are covered in IFRS 9 other than what is comes up as a result of the proposals in the DP for separate presentation requirements. So it's clearly focusing on what is there currently in IAS 32. We are also, the discussion papers you'll see as you go through is pretty heavy on disclosure and presentation. So there's a significant section on disclosure and presentation that we are covering, but to do with issuers' respective equity instruments. Liabilities, Mary will cover that. We don't think there's much more information that's required other than some bits, but main primary focus is on equity instruments disclosures. Now, looking at the impact, and certainly one of the objectives of the discussion paper is to find the impact going through when we go to the comment letters and everything and the outreach process. The board is seeking to limit any unnecessary changes to the classifications that come out of 32. We know 32 has worked well in most instances. It's only on those complex and other areas and also new instruments that have come up after the crisis. The standard is about 20 years old, so it's those instruments that we are looking at, but we don't, the objective is not to change classification outcomes that are well understood and established within 32. That's certainly the objective. That's how we have tried to go about it. It's for the more complex instruments that we have tried to address it and tried to give a basis. What does not change upfront is in slide 6, which we have put in there, is the definition of a financial instrument, because that's massively encompassing. It not only affects 32, it affects everything that's under 9 and all other aspects. The putables exception, which is there in IAS 32, that is carried forward. The conclusions in IFRIC 2 that are being carried forward. and the way classification would or would not be affected by what we call economic compulsion and laws and regulation. And we have a separate section in the discussion paper with a question in that as well. So these are the key items that are being carried forward in the discussion paper from IS 32 without any alterations. Sorry, Andres.
Are you taking questions along, or do you want to park them until the end?
I suggest that you ask questions as they come along.
Yeah.
Okay. As regards the definition of a financial instrument, and particularly the definition of an equity instrument, there is noise in the market, put it that way, between the issuers and the holders' perspective. And that concerns, obviously, putable instruments, which are deemed equity for presentation purposes in 32, but are not deemed equity instruments under 9 from a holder's perspective. Are you planning to look into this issue again from the holder's perspective, not from the issuer's perspective? Because you're saying we are not going to touch this from the issuer's perspective in here?
The holder's perspective.
Yes.
As of now, in the discussion paper, Andres, there's no intention to touch the holder's accounting, which is coming out from the IFRS 9, and because, as it follows, the DP looks at it from the issuer's perspective, what is the classification, and that's not changing. So, yes, I know, I'm aware of that, yes.
And I think that also reflects the fact, Andreas, that the, one of the reasons why we've kept the, or proposing keeping the putables exception in 32 is because of the sort of odd results you can get from the issuer's perspective if you've got no equity.
Yeah.
And obviously that same issue doesn't arise on the holder's perspective. So I think we would see that as a distinction. Having said that, it's a discussion paper, so
People
can raise points, obviously.
Okay. But you're not actively seeking any comments on that one, but you wouldn't be concerned if we flag that from a holder's perspective. So just to say, if you say this instrument is, as an exception, treated as an equity instrument from the holder's perspective, why does that classification not come through to the holder's side as well? Because I would say that the risk position of a holder in that instrument is really more akin to an equity risk than it is to a debt line instrument. But that's the question. Are you seeking comments or would you
not specifically?
Not specifically, no. Okay. If you go to slide 7 and drawing attention to that, because that's how we would follow it, that gives the structure of the discussion paper, how it is structured. The discussion paper, the way it is structured, it sets out the objectives, the scope, and the challenges that the board is trying to address through this discussion paper. As we said, one of our objectives is not to make unnecessary changes to the classification outcomes in 32. So that's one of the objectives. But at the same time, the board is aware of quite a few of the challenges that have come up in practice from 32, the interpretation committee questions that couldn't be have been pending, which people have told us you need to look at it in more detail. And then how the discussion paper goes about addressing these challenges as we build through the approach, because that's how we link up, that if we do it, does it address this challenge, and this is what it is structured. Then the DP talks about what is the board's preferred approach, going on to classification of non-derivatives, and then to derivatives and compounds, and then we go on to presentation and disclosure. And of course, last bit is the one I mentioned, is about contractual terms and economic compulsion, where there are specific questions on it. And that's how we have structured this presentation as well. So with that, I think we go straight into the first section of objective scope and challenges. Sue?
Okay, thanks, Kumar. So on slide 9. So in this section, I'm covering the first section of the discussion paper, which really sets out the board's position in terms of what it is that, what problem we think we're trying to solve and how we decided on the scope that we're proposing to investigate and seek feedback on. And by way of background, when we came to this project, based on the feedback we've had, particularly from recent agenda consultations, I think the thing that we've heard is that 32's worked relatively well in most cases. It worked pretty well even during the financial crisis and stress conditions. But we do know that it's quite an old standard and there's been a lot of financial innovation. And so we've certainly seen at the Interpretations Committee a number of more bespoke instruments that have been developed over time where it can be difficult to work out what the classification should be under 32. So one of the things we're trying to do is to address that. The other thing that strikes you when you look at IAS 32 is that sometimes it is the case that you can see what the answer is in terms of classification, but then articulating to people why it's the answer is a challenging thing to do. So that, for me, is another part of it. And then we know when we talk to investors that there's some frustration about the lack of information that's provided in the financial statements about financial instruments that issuers issue, and that that's particularly the case for equity instruments, because basically we require pretty much no information other than earnings per share type information if an instrument's issued that meets the definition of equity. And because of these challenges, we know that investors sometimes feel they've got insufficient information, and also because of the challenges with finding the correct classification or understanding the correct classification, we know there's some diversity in application, and we've seen that live at the Interpretations Committee, where there's been a number of instruments where we've been unable to conclude on the accounting as required by 32 today. So that was the sort of background to why we decided to take on the project. Moving to slide 10, what do we think has caused these problems? And I think there's really two main things that we're trying to focus on. Firstly, when you look at 32, I think I haven't heard anybody who would dispute the fact that it's really a bit of a bag of rules, and there's not much articulation for the rationale underlying the particular classifications. And so one of the first things that we're trying to do is to articulate the principles underlying the classification outcomes. So what you'll actually see a lot when you look at the discussion paper is that the outcomes can usually actually be the same as you get to under 32, but we've tried to articulate the reason for why we've got there. And so we're trying to come up with a better explanation and also articulation of the rationale for classification under 32. The second thing that the board has been focusing on is that we're sticking with the proposal of just having two classifications still. It's debt or equity, or some instruments can have features of both, so they could be compound instruments split into parts. But we know that financial instruments can range all the way from sort of short-term trade creditors all the way through to ordinary shares and every variant along the spectrum, thanks to financial innovation. And having a debt-equity distinction can only ever tell us one piece of the picture. So the board's also decided that in addition to trying to improve the articulation of the classification, we need to use presentation and disclosure to add some colour to the picture. So you get debt and equity classification, that's one piece of information, but you need more. And Mary will talk about some of those ideas later on.
Just a comment, just to stress this last point, I believe this point is really, really important, because this element of financial innovation, it will happen again in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, so disclosure is really necessary, especially disclosure about the condition of the contract of the instrument itself. So, what is really this instrument? How it articulates with other variables like financial metrics, non financial metrics, etc. So this is very important, because otherwise, in 10 years' time, we're going to have the same book.
I think that's true. On slide 11, we've just repeated the questions that are in the discussion paper at the end of section one. And really, the first thing we ask people to comment on when they respond to us on the discussion paper is whether they agree with the challenges that we've identified and the causes of those challenges from our point of view. And perhaps, most importantly, for a research project, do you actually think it's worth us working on standard setting to try and address these challenges, given the priorities for the board? So that's section one. So now moving on to section two and the board's preferred approach. And you'll see, you might remember that during the life of this history, we've had these fancy names, gamma and delta, and I could never remember which was which. And in the discussion paper, we've just moved to talking about the board's preferred approach, which I think is much neater. Not least because now I don't have to remember which is which. And on slide 13, we've tried to set out what the basic idea is. And at 30,000 feet, which is a nice place to operate, I think the idea of the classification is very simple in this discussion paper. And I say to a lot of people who I've been talking to in the last week that if you go away from this presentation and all you remember is this one slide, I think that's still a big help when you pick up the document and start to read it, because it really sets the scene for the classification concept in the DP. So basically what the document proposes is that if somebody issues, an entity issues a financial instrument, they really have to ask themselves two questions, and if the answer is yes to one or both of those questions, then the answer is, ta-da, you have a liability. And if that's not the case, you have an equity instrument. So what are the two questions? So the first question that we ask the entity is, as an issuer, can the holder require you to deliver cash to them or require you to hand over another financial asset before your liquidation? And we call that the timing feature. Can you be forced to hand over cash or a financial asset before liquidation? So if you answer yes to that, you've got a liability. The second question you get asked is, have you promised a return to the holder, the amount of which is independent of your own performance? Now, those aren't the words that we use in the DP, but that's the idea. The idea is the claim on you independent of your own performance or not? And if the answer to that question is yes, you also have a liability, and we call that test the amount feature. Now, we spent months and months and months just developing this test, and the way that we came about it that's described in the discussion paper is trying to really step back and think about what it is that users of financial statements want to understand about financial instruments. And the next two slides try and explain why we focused on this timing feature, do I have to hand over cash, and this amount feature, is the claim independent of the entity's performance. So firstly, the timing feature, on slide 14. And really the timing feature, we think this question of whether you've got a claim that means you have to hand over cash before your liquidation is relevant to investors because it helps them assess whether an entity is going to be able to meet its liquidity or funding requirements and have sufficient cash flow to meet their claims as they arise over time. And so the example that we have on slide 14 says that if I have an entity that's funded with one liability, the top one, to pay cash next month of 30, and you've got another obligation to pay cash of 70 next year, and then you've got something like ordinary shares where you wouldn't have to pay back until liquidation, it's interesting to be able to contrast those two instruments where I actually have to pay cash on a scheduled date with the thing where I never have to pay anything back until liquidation. And distinguishing between those two things in the first instance is interesting, which is why we ask the first question, can I be obliged to pay cash or hand over financial assets before my liquidation?
Some instruments have a mezzanine feature, which is like preferred shares that are required to pay cash, but they're required to pay a percentage of earnings. So not like the typical American preferred shares that you're required to pay, say, 9% a year, but you're required to pay 30% or 25% of your profits.
If you're required to pay it, then it would be a liability.
But
because it's linked to performance, you'd also tick the other box. So hold that instrument, and I'll come back to where it sits in the classification.
It makes the timing, amount.
Both tests, exactly.
The dividend payment meets the liability feature.
Yep.
The coupon.
It's not a coupon. It's a percentage of profit.
The amount that's due over time.
25%. You have to pay quarterly or annually 25% of your profits.
The periodic amount that you pay over time is a liability.
Would there be another? Not the principal.
There'd be the other question about the maturity amount, if you like.
It's assuming the maturity is perpetual and you don't have
a perpetual preferred share, you have to pay 25% or 30% or whatever.
So if I look at my periodic payment, to use a neutral term, on that instrument and look at the two questions, I have to pay cash, so tick that box. Mm-hmm. But is the amount independent of my performance? No, because it's moving with my performance. So I'd say no to the second question, but yes to the first one.
Yeah.
And you just have to tick one box and you're a liability.
The reason I mentioned this instrument is a nice example here.
Yeah.
Because you have exactly the both features, one for the principal and a different one for the dividends. And it's a good example, really.
It is a good example.
Excuse me. On the timing feature, I should have a look, but what do you do with variable capital? You know, when you have a number of institutions on a number of markets where shares the capital can be variable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be required to pay cash if there is some sort of a reduction in capital.
That comes into the contingency. If you've got an obligation where you would have to pay out if your tier one capital isn't high enough, that type of instrument, because that obligation is considered to be outside your control, that would be a liability as well.
Maybe should we hold that one and come back to it after we've gone through and we'll test how you might analyze that once we work through the whole model?
Yep.
Because it's a good one.
Yep. Okay, so that was the timing feature. Now moving to the amount feature. So the amount feature on slide 15 is the second part of the test, and the reason why we think this is a relevant part of the test to identify or distinguish between liabilities and equity is because if you've got an obligation to deliver an amount to the holder of the instrument which is not moving with the performance of the entity, you may not be able to meet the claim. So let's look at the example that we've got here on the picture on slide 15. So I've got assets at the date that I issued the instrument of 150. I've got claims, the residual. Let's say that's ordinary shares that are worth 50 at the time I issue the instrument. And then I've got an obligation to pay 100 in the future. Now I move to the next period and my assets have fallen in value to 120. In this case, I can still meet the claim of 100, but you can see the residual's taken the difference. But it could have a situation where the assets had actually fallen to only 80. Now, in this case, if I've got an obligation to deliver value of 100, even if it's in my own ordinary shares, I can't meet that obligation because my whole company's assets are only worth 80, and I've got a fixed claim of 100, even if that's in my own shares. So the fact that I may not be able to meet the claim, even if it's due in my own shares, whatever the form. So the second test doesn't say, is it cash? It just says, what's the amount of the claim? That would meet the liability definition. And that's because in this situation, because the claim is not moving with the performance of the entity, it's a fixed claim of 100, no matter what's happening to the net, to my net assets of my company, I may not be able to meet that obligation, and so therefore it meets the definition of a liability. So this would be why, for example, the shares to the value of 100, the shares to the value of type test, the variable share instrument would be liability classified under the proposed approach, the same way as it is under 32, but with a rationale for it being this focus on the amount test, as we call it, which really looks at solvency and returns.
If I recall, this feature will mean that some instruments where final mandatory settlement is only on liquidation would be liabilities. So is that a rearticulation of the principle in IAS 32, or is that a different principle?
It's a bit of a combination. So if I've got an instrument where, say, in 5 years' time I have to deliver an amount of 100 in my own shares, then that's a liability because I may not be able to deliver the value because of this idea here. Mm-hmm. But what you're getting at is the fact that under 32 today we say ignore liquidation. So what happens on liquidation doesn't matter to classification. And that's one change in the discussion paper. If you have, for example, the clearest example of where it's a different classification would be if I had a perpetual preference share, but it's got a cumulative obligation. Even though you can put that payment, all those coupon, those periodic payments off forever, definitely compounding until the ultimate liquidation of the company. Because it's a claim which is not changing with the value of the entity, it's building and building and building, that would be liability classified under the board's preferred approach, which is different to the outcome under 32. So you're right, it's sort of it's a confirmation and a slight expansion from what's in 32.
Jim?
Is performance of the entity, without reading it, is it book value, fair value? For example, Alessandro's instrument was a liability, at least a portion of it, for a different reason, but you said that was, you know, linked to performance. That's book value, or that's GAAP earnings performance. Other instruments will be, you know, change in fair value of all of the entity's net assets. Is that defined?
It's not. I'll try answering that, and then Kumar, you step in. It's articulated as a more economic concept than just a pure accounting concept. So it's articulated in terms of would I be able to meet the claim. But I think the two practical examples to make it operational that are used in the discussion paper are really sort of yes and no to your question. One is the comprehensive income, movements in comprehensive income, and the other is the example we use is based on share price, the fair value of your share price. So we use two different articulations.
So just a question. I was just interested in whether I can't quite, in my mind, distinguish between funding liquidity and balance sheet solvency, they actually seem to be the same thing in terms of can you actually meet the claim that's...
Well, so let me use two different examples. So let's say that I've got a claim which is based on my share price. So if I do really, really badly, the value of that claim falls and falls and falls and falls, so it becomes less of an obligation the worse I do. In theory, if that's, you know, measured perfectly, that could never cause you to be insolvent because in the worst-case scenario, it might be worth zero. But I do have to write a check if you come and ask me to put your share, for example. So in that case, it's not affecting my solvency because, in theory, as my performance gets worse and worse and worse, your claimer gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But it still could have an effect on my liquidity because you're still going to come and ask me to write a check, which is different to an obligation where you come and ask me for $100 in all circumstances. So that's the difference. One is, do I have to write a check? Could be a fixed amount or a moving amount. It's always got a liquidity consequence. But the other amount one is, the amount of the claim is sort of directionally directly correlated with my performance. And so if I do really well, my obligation goes up. But if I do really terribly, you might actually be entitled to nothing. And so it's absorbing risk in the same way an ordinary shareholder is from an amount perspective. But if you can ask me for it in cash, it's still got a liquidity implication. Those are the two things we're trying to contrast.
Andreas?
Would it be fair to characterise that issue as notional versus fair value measurements? Because this is a notional consideration that you have here. If you suppose that the claim on an independent amount was fair value because the fair value option was exercised, then I think you would end up with a different treatment because then equity probably wouldn't be reduced by 30 but by an amount less than that because the debt holders would also take part of that share. So I think that there is probably a relationship between classification per se, as you are doing it here, which is coming from a notional perspective, but it could be overlaid by measurement considerations later on.
So you're talking about an instrument where... So if I've got an instrument where you actually do have a claim for 100, just a fixed amount of 100, right? Now, the value of that claim in the market might move around because my credit risk might influence the value of that. But as long as you're actually entitled to claim 100 from me, our model would say that's an independent amount and therefore you tick the liability box. So the fact the fair value might be fluctuating all over the place means it doesn't matter because it's the amount of the claim that matters. Mm-hmm. But in contrast, if you had a situation where actually the amount of the claim varied because of that fair value movement, then yes, you're right, it might change the classification. But what the analysis is based on is what can you actually rock up and sue me for?
Yes.
It's the contractual. It's a contractual side.
Yeah.
That's what you mean, right?
Address
for the notion. Yes, absolutely. We're looking at the contractual amount. As Sue mentioned, what can move, that's how we do it.
But it's amount versus value.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a bit of a discussion where we are careful when we, especially in the derivative section, when we go into the net.
The amount of the claim.
Yeah, net amount of the claim. Absolutely.
It's not a fair value focus unless the claim is based on fair value.
What?
I mean, to Chris's point, first of all, I think, since we aired our dirty laundry in public as we were debating this, we might as well say it again. We found it difficult to try and say this is one absolutely clean silo of solvency. This is one absolutely clean silo of liquidity, which is why we moved to the very exciting alpha and beta and gamma discussions, which has now been dressed up as the board's preferred approach in terms of naming. But for me, the example that makes what Sue was talking about really come alive is the issue of NCI puts. So because that's something that does go up and down with a proportionate share of the claims of a subsidiary. So it's fully at risk in terms of if it's a fair value put. But we heard a very strong feedback from users of financial statements that if somebody can, in Sue's words, rock up and make a claim on your cash, they want that classified as a liability because they want to know about what the amount of cash is that can be demanded from the company prior to liquidation, even though that value, if it's a fair value put, is fluctuating entirely with the with the fair value of the equity of the subsidiary.
Kimberly.
I guess I have a couple of questions just to follow up on that point, because I remember this word solvency came up a while ago, and I think maybe it was in some work that Brad did that was looking at this. And did you ever think about using another word than solvency? Because if I think about the returns, because you talk about solvency and returns, and certainly if you go back through the literature, there's always been the two ways of thinking about debt equity has been, have I got an obligation to pay cash, which is a time piece, and the other way of thinking about it, does it share in the returns like an ordinary shareholder? So a simple profit sharing arrangement, is a liability because of the timing. Obviously, the amounts fluctuating with the performance of the entity. So I think the concepts of sort of aligning the two legs are recognised from that, you know, that thinking that's always been there. But when you use the word label solvencies, that's where I got really confused about it, until you sort of explained what you were talking about there. Because I even Googled solvency this morning to see, well, what does it mean? And the definition, of course, used liquidity. It talked about... a good measure of it is adding up your cash and comparing that to your long-term liabilities. Now, talking about, and so did you think about using another word?
The answer is we went through loads of different articulations, and as Mary said, at one point we gave up on trying to even use the words because it was causing so much confusion at the table, and used alpha and beta and gamma, and then people like me couldn't even remember what those meant. So...
could you just use the word returns, I guess?
We do use returns more. We do talk about the variability of the returns and whether the claim can be met more in the articulation and in the actual discussion paper. I think we probably use solvency more as shorthand in the slides than we do in the discussion paper.
Yes, absolutely. Fair point, Kimberly. We went through this, as you know, from the things. In the discussion paper, when we look at what is driving the key features which will drive be the resulting classification. For the user assessment, that's when we refer to solvency, but that too not too frequently. But afterwards, we have been very careful to move to returns. And when we tried, but have a look, see, we have tried very hard because of the reason you mentioned, because different people have different interpretation, and it's a very difficult term to define. Yes, we have tried that.
And we don't actually use the words in the test per se.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we sort of get a free pass, because the whole idea we're talking about here is having a better underpinning and articulation. So ultimately, if we end up with a standard, with a basis, we'll need to use some words to support these that make sense to people. So your comments are fair. So
And my second question is based on the way that you've described it. You know that it could get to the point where you have, like in this example, the loss is so big that the amount of that claim is bigger than the total or the net assets, and suddenly you can't meet it. Does that mean that effectively under the amount test, the instrument should have a similar profile as an ordinary share? So ultimately, it is sitting alongside ordinary shares as the most residual on winding up, because that's the only circumstance in which.
Or it could be something like, I think that is probably true. Yes, in most cases. But the exception to that would be a non-cumulative preference share, because if you've just never have to pay, in that situation, even though in a liquidation the claim that would be left would just be the original 100, because on a present value basis for a going concern entity, that's sort of nothing. We've said that would meet the definition of equity. Mm. But I think, yes, you're right. Other than that, it really does need to have a return profile that looks... or be based on the value of the shares or comprehensive income. So it does depend on the articulation, but something that's, say, 30% of total assets, or even something small that you think you're never going to bust, like 5% of total assets, because in theory there's a scenario where you wouldn't be able to meet it, that would be a liability. So it's not the likelihood of busting the ratio, which I think is part of what you're getting at, which is correct.
And with that exception you mentioned, is that related to paragraph 3.24? be in the discussion paperwork, which is the irredeemable non-cumulative preference share of the state equivalent of an amount that's a specified rate of return or a specified amount of cash.
But the coupon a little bit, Kim.
It's a irredeemable non-cumulative preference share with basically a fixed amount. Yeah. But the coupon or dividend can be cancelled if it's not paid by the entity, so it doesn't accumulate. And it says, because the entity has the unconditional right to avoid paying coupons or dividends, this stream of cash flows is not considered to be independent of the available resources. This is focusing on the amount, not the timing. But the reason we focus on the timing rather than the amount. So is that your exception? Is that something to do with?
It's a combination. So it's timing because you don't have to ever pay it.
Yeah.
But it's also amount, because the amount that you would ever have to pay is only ever the original 100. And because we assume that it's a going concern basis, the present value of that is so small because it's perpetual until your liquidation that we think the amount is basically zero. That's how I think about it.
But you always have to do both tests, because you have to pass both timing and amount to get to equity. So it isn't enough to pass one of the tests to show you're playing on one.
I get that, and that's why, you know, if I looked at the timing test, you know, traditionally we'd just look at timing and say, well, discretionary dividends means it's equity because I've got no obligation to pay cash. And then this is actually using the same rationale answer the amount test, but because I thought the amount test was a different principle, a different concept, I couldn't see how the rationale for the timing test was relevant to the amount. So that's why I'm sort of struggling, but I'll have to spend some more time thinking about it.
Well, if it's cumulative, then you are sort of, in a sense, promising, even though it's only on liquidation, a return which is divorced from the performance of the entity, because in theory, if you've issued the instrument and you've always done really badly, and so badly that ultimately you've gone into liquidation, the amount would have built up to quite a sizable sum by the time you get to liquidation, and that would then be an actual claim on the entity, which is a big claim, even though you're in a very bad position. So I think that's how it fits in with the logic of the amount.
So going back to what you said before about, can it ever get bigger than the assets, because it can be deferred?
Yep.
It never could grow.
Exactly. Right. So that's why we make quite a distinction between cumulative and non-cumulative. But this whole focus, which Andrew rightly pointed out early on what happens in liquidation, is actually a really quite a big change for me from 32. So it's going to be an important thing to get feedback on, because we had quite a debate at the board table about whether or not it's appropriate to think about the liquidation claim, a claim that only arises in liquidation and going concern accounting, which this model does, because it thinks about what would the amount be in that situation, which is quite a difference from 32.
So just an example here to see if I understand it correctly here. A typical COCO instrument used by financial institutions is a perpetual bond paying, some say, 6% a year. But you don't actually, if the certain conditions are not met, for example, if the financial institution has not a capital ratio over a certain amount, you actually don't pay anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the principal component is really dependent on the financial institution's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's financial institution's performance on a fair value or cost basis or whatever. But the you can say, well, the coupon would be a financial, it would be a liability because you're obliged to pay. At the same point, you say, well, what's a fair value of that instrument? It would be the present value of the coupons that would be paid in perpetuity. That would generally be the case. Unless an institution is in some sort of distress, because if it's in some sort of distress, the fair value of the instrument would be very low. So that will cause, that's the point I want to understand, we cause the principal amount to be classified as equity.
Well,
you're not required to pay anymore.
It depends.
It's dependent on your performance.
It makes me nervous when we start off talking about a typical COCO to start with.
It's just hypothetical one here.
But if the instrument includes a feature which says that if, in theory, you woke up tomorrow morning and you didn't have enough Tier 1 capital, you would now have to issue ordinary shares to the holders worth 100, if that's what the instrument said.
The one is a simple one that you don't have to issue ordinary shares. It's just
relief from paying the coupon.
I understand the complexity. It's a very complex instrument, but it's very simple.
But I just wanted to work this, and I'll just make this one point because I think it's an important point. If you've got a COCO instrument, and I know some that do exist, which say that if at any time you run out of capital, this instrument then converts into 100 currency units worth of shares. And that could happen tomorrow. Because it could happen tomorrow, even if it's pretty unimaginable that it would happen tomorrow, and your investors don't think that's going to be the case, that would be a liability under this instrument because you've got an unavoidable obligation for a fixed amount that could be due tomorrow, and we don't look at the probability per se.
But in that example you gave, the fixed amount is the key to it.
Yes, exactly.
Let's forget
because the principal amount's a fixed amount.
Yeah, let's forget about fixed amount. Yeah. It just don't be.
So what was your test again?
If your tier one capital goes below X.
For example, if you go below 10%, you don't pay anything. Not the principal, because those
instruments are... And it's non-cumulative?
In these bonds, Alessandro, firstly, the principal amount what you're saying, these are perpetuals, right?
Yes, perpetuals.
So the entire fair value of that comes from the dividend stream or the interest coupon stream. So there's nothing in the principal amount. And if this instrument, you can avoid payment only if certain conditions happen, then the test is, are those conditions within your control?
Well,
and the answer
is performance of...
That's not within your control.
So that would be a
lot. That's a very important point. Sorry to ask this because it's not clear for me. The performance of the institution that is issued is not under the institution's control.
I don't think we have seen a lot of instruments, and Sue will back me up with this one, with profit links and other things, where you can always argue that I can make losses and not make payment. That's not something we would say is within consideration.
No, so,
I'm sorry if I misread it, but I read it carefully. So it's not that clear for me, reading the paper.
So the idea in the DP...
Very important distinction.
So the idea in the DP is that if you've got an obligation that's outside your control, either because the holder can make you do it, so they can come and just ask for cash and you have to give it to them if they want it, or if it's based on... market prices or something like that, that's outside your control, or if it's based on what your profit is or what your tier one capital is or something like that, all of those things would be considered outside your control. Therefore, because they're unavoidable, that means that if you have to write a check dependent on those conditions, then that would meet the definition of a liability. Now, that might not be as clear as we'd like in the document, but that's the idea.
Maybe it's my mistake, but I always read the performance of the firm as something under my control. At least I always read it that way.
We do have a section, it's later in the DP in Chapter 5, where we look at performance alternatives within and without the control of their debt. Yeah.
Okay.
But Alessandro, a couple things. If you look at slide 16, this has wording that is closer, I think, though, Kumar, it's not exactly the wording, but it's a slightly abbreviated version of the wording of the two conditions. We got the plain English version of can somebody rock up and demand cash is the return that's promised outside the entity's control. So if you look at B, unavoidable, as Kumar was just saying, understanding that unavoidable is not inevitable. Unavoidable is not within your absolute control. And for an amount independent of the entity's available economic resources, that's the more precise statement. Kimberly, to your point about what do we mean? It isn't enough to say because the condition of not paying is linked to how I performed. In your example, if I don't make at least X, or if my tier one capital isn't at least X, I don't have to pay. The fact that it is in some way linked is not enough. It has to be unavoidable. So it has to be entirely within your control that you avoid the obligation, and the amount has basically any independence from the entity's performance makes it a liability. So that's why it's important to look at the actual wording in the document. And I believe you when you say you read it carefully. So I think we've taken away the point that we have to make clear that the entity's performance is considered to be something that is not entirely within their control.
I believe most people saw unavoidable as a typical debt that I have to pay no matter what.
We intend something broader.
Yeah.
So it's good to clarify that. Yeah. So on slide 16, as Mary said, that the next question basically in the DP is whether you agree that this focus on amount and timing is the right, are the right areas of focus to decide what's a liability versus what's equity. Now, obviously, instruments have lots of other features as well, voting rights, there's dilution effects, there's all sorts of other bells and whistles that go with instruments. We propose that those are addressed through presentation and disclosure, and that these two particular aspects of instruments are what we focus on for classification. Okay, so now in the next session, I'm going to see if I can explain now applying this model to some instruments, and we've already covered some of these, so we might be able to go through this quite quickly. So on slide 18, this is trying to show in a diagram how this amount and timing feature sits together and therefore what ends up being a liability. And I'm hoping that when Mary gets to presentation and disclosure, she might allude back to these examples a little bit, because I think for me it helps me understand how the classification model fits with the presentation and disclosure requirements, because there's particular features that some liabilities have that others don't that we then focus in on for disclosure and presentation. So this here shows you that these are my two questions more neatly or more formally articulated. So on the column on the left, this is my question: do I have an obligation to pay cash or transfer another financial asset prior to liquidation? It's actually articulated in the document as: do I have an obligation to transfer economic resources at a specified time other than liquidation? If the answer to that is yes, then I'm in that top row and I've got a liability, irrespective of whether that's a fixed amount or an amount that moves, say, with my share price. That's a liability because I have to write a check. The second test is articulated in the top row of the matrix, where we say, and this is the amount feature. So this is asking the question of whether or not the obligation that you have, and remember this is whether it's in cash or my own shares, whatever form it takes, whether the amount of the claim the holder has is independent of my performance or not. And this is, again, closer to the formal words in the document. So it asks the question, does the instrument contain an obligation for an amount independent of the entity's available economic resources? And so if the answer to that question is yes, irrespective of the form, cash, my own shares, whatever, that's a liability, and that's the middle section of this matrix. And so that means that if you answer no to both questions, I'm in the equity section right down in the bottom corner. Otherwise, I've got a liability. Some have ticked yes to both and one just one or the other. So just to drill it in, we've just got a couple of easy examples on the next few pages which try to show the different quadrants of the matrix. So on slide 19... Sorry.
I think that was a really important point. So when you say economic resources, that means your own shares as well.
No.
No.
Economic resources is... No, it's not. Economic resources is cash or financial assets, basically.
You just use the word shares then, so that's what I just wanted to understand.
That's my entity's available economic resources. So one is, do I have an obligation to transfer my economic resources, which is my cash? And then the independence test is the amount of the entity's available economic resources, which is a fancy way of saying net assets.
Mm-hmm. It kind of sounds a bit circular, because in some instances you are saying there will be circumstances where there's things that you would otherwise have said is shares or something else that you think is your own equity. And we sort of, and there was something in the DP that says, well, if it's your own equity, then it's not considered to be...
Economic resources. We'll come to that. It affects the net shares settled instruments. Yeah. Let's wait for the derivatives. We'll cover that, Chris. Yes, absolutely. That's where the net share settled comes in. Yeah.
Okay, so example one, the simplest instrument on slide 19, is just a 5-year bond. I've got an obligation to pay a coupon of 5 every year and then to repay 100 at maturity at year 5. Is that a liability? Hopefully, pretty obviously, yes, because I've got an obligation to pay cash before liquidation, and the amount of the obligation is independent of my performance. So that's a purple section of my matrix because I've said yes to both boxes. Example two, slightly harder. So I've issued an instrument for 100, and in this case, my obligation is to issue the holder my own shares in 1 year's time, and I have to deliver my own shares worth 110. So I don't have an obligation to transfer cash, so no for that, but I do have an obligation to give you value of 110 irrespective of my performance. So that's a liability, and that's in the bottom left-hand red box of the matrix. Example three is something akin to the non-NCI put that Mary alluded to before. So example three, I've issued a share to the holder, and that share gives them the same rights as an ordinary shareholder, but it's got an additional feature, which is that the holder of the instrument can choose to redeem it at their option in 1 year one year's time for its then fair value. So timing feature, is there an obligation to transfer cash? Yes, but the amount of the obligation is moving with the performance of the entity because it's moving with the value of my ordinary shares. So this is like a putable share if they don't meet the putables exception or an NCI put, or Alexandro's example where the coupon on the instrument was moving with the amount of profitability I was making. That coupon stream has this feature as well. And you can see on slide 22, we've tried to populate this matrix with some examples to help illustrate how the document works. So bonds and loans, got to pay a fixed amount in cash, so they say yes to both tests. Share settled debt, you've got an obligation independent of your available resources, even though it's share settled. It's in the red section. And my putable shares on slide 22 are moving with the performance of the entity. So in good times, a higher obligation. In bad times, may not have to pay anything, but you do have to hand over cash if the instrument is put. So that's the last example. And the reason why I'm hoping that Mary will allude to this is because obviously there's a big difference between the five-year bond where you have to pay 100 at maturity and a coupon along the way and an instrument where it's like an ordinary share except you can put it for its value in 1 year's time. And because it's very different types of liabilities, but they're all in the liability category, you can see we've got a whole range of stuff, share-settled debt, normal bonds, putable shares, all with a liability label. That's why we need presentation and disclosure to help investors understand they've all got a liability label, but these are very different animals, and that's a lot of the focus of the document. Now, on slide 23, in the DP, we don't talk about, even though I used assets to explain the ideas, we don't use those words in the DP. We talk about available economic resources. What do we mean by that? We mean the total recognised and unrecognised assets of the entity net of the total recognised and unrecognised claims on the entity. And we use the word claims in the discussion paper because we think all instruments are claims of a form. We don't talk about liabilities and equity in the first instance. We talk about claims on the entity. And the available economic resources is the net of those two amounts. Cool. Well, you use this when you're looking at classifying a particular instrument. So you're asking when you come to look at the terms of the instrument that you're trying to classify, given the total resources, total economic resources of the entity, and all of the claims on the entity before I start looking at this instrument, could this instrument leave me in a position where, for example, I can't meet the claims because it could exceed what's left over? Now, this is one of the most challenging parts of the document, of course, to be completely candid, because I'm here with fellow standard setters and we'll need help on this if this is a model we develop. We can't use the word net assets because it becomes completely circular.
Right.
And so this is why we talk about available economic resources, to try and avoid the circularity. But it's very difficult not to become circular. So that's why these words have been used. So if you've got better suggestions when you comment, we'd be very open to hearing.
I suggest with that diagram that if the blue bits should be available economic resources to pay the instrument in question.
Okay.
Yep.
It's kind of in the footnote, but
it's a fair point. Now, on slide 24, and this builds a little bit on the question which Jim asked me early on, which is a hard question to answer, what do we actually mean by an amount that's independent of the available economic resources? We talk about this really in two ways. So The easy one, if you like, is an amount that just doesn't change no matter what goes on. So if I've got a claim for 100, that's pretty obviously independent of the performance of the entity. That's my easy one. The harder one is the second one, and that is if the amount changes as a result of changes in the available economic resources but does so in a way that could exceed the available economic resources, then that also is considered not to be, is considered to be independent of the entity's available economic resources. Now, on slide 25, we've tried to illustrate this. So on the left-hand side, the easy case, a fixed obligation that just doesn't move, obviously, is independent of the entity's available economic resources. But sometimes you can have an amount which does move somewhat in relation to the change in the performance of the entity, but it could still be misaligned. And perhaps the example that we use most frequently to describe this would be the second one on slide 26, which would be, if I've got a bond that entitles the holder to 30% of the value of the entity's total assets, that is independent, even though it's moving somewhat with the resource, available economic resources, because it's moving with total assets. Because the other claims on the entity could exceed 70% of the total assets, so if they really fell in value, that would not be, that would be considered independent and therefore a liability. And we spend quite a bit of time in the discussion paper discussing what this concept of independence means. Okay. As I said, that's where we'll really appreciate feedback, because it's quite difficult to articulate.
I think you need to change the wording in that example. So I finally got what you meant, but when you said talking about 70% of total assets, that didn't really do it for me. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of say 30% of total assets could exceed, and go back to that other wording.
Okay.
I think actually putting numbers on it helps. I had to actually do numbers myself this morning to remind myself how it worked. So
yeah.
I think it's a fair point. It's not terribly intuitive when you've been away from it for a while. And so on slide 27, the third and fourth question in the DP is really asking you whether or not you agree that this proposed rearticulation of the features of an instrument that would be classified as a liability and or as equity in reverse are, you know, a good proposal or not. And also we specifically focus on whether we should keep the putables exception, because we had quite a discussion about that at the board table. We've proposed retaining it, but we asked a specific question in the document about whether or not people agree with the retention of the putables exception. It would be nice in a way to have a model which has got no exceptions and it's nice and pure, but on the other hand, we know that there were good reasons for the putables exception which the board felt were still valid reasons. So, but the board at the time, because there were strong differences of view, decided that we should have an explicit question on the putables exception in the DP.
There is no such a thing in accounting as nice and pure. So,
related to slide 24... Paragraph 3.17 of the discussion paper defined the entity's available economic resources as the total recognized and unrecognized asset of the entity that remains after deducting all other recognized and unrecognized claims against the entity. Under this definition, my understanding is that the capital structure of an entity would affect its available economic resources, and as a result, the same instrument could be classified differently depending on the entity's capital structure. So is my understanding is correct?
Could you give us a little bit, when you say cap, because we talk about available economic resources, and that's the point Chris raised, because we talk about everything, all claims. We don't talk about equity, all liability. It's all claims against the entity. So it's based at a point in time. What are all the claims against the entity will determine your available economic resources. So how those claims are distributed between liability and equity, I'm indifferent. Is that what you mean by capital structure, UQ?
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you, you know, one example. The example would be the bond raised as the second example on the slide 26, which entitled the holder to 30% of the value of the entity's total asset. Such bond is normally independent of the entity's available economic resources and classified into liability in terms of the amount future. However, suppose all the claims of the entity consist of only that bond and ordinary share. In such case, the amount of claim other than bond would never exceed 70% of the total asset. This means that the bond is dependent of the entity's available economic resources and classified into equity as a result of in terms of the amount future. So that's my, you know.
I think that, and I'm testing my memory here, but I think that the intention is that it's not the case, because you have to consider the possibility that in the future the entity could issue other fixed claims. So it's not just thinking about what they have on issue today, but what they could have on issue in the future. Is that not correct, Kumar? So if you had a situation where you only had a bond which said it was entitled to 30% of their total assets and ordinary shares, Yukio's right, you could always meet the value of that claim because you only have all of the buffering is going to the ordinary shareholders. But because the entity could issue fixed claims in the future, I think we would say that no, it doesn't meet the test.
I think we say it doesn't meet the test. I need to check that. I think it's at a point
from
in
memory,
time.
Yukio. Yeah. The intention is that you wouldn't get a different outcome, but I'll have a look at the DP and come back and clarify. I haven't
Isn't
looked at
that. Though, within their control? Unlike performance, you control whether you do something in the future or not.
But because the concept is meant to be, is the value of the claim moving around with performance of the net assets? And because in this case, this is clearly a claim which isn't independent of net assets because it's based on total assets, I think the articulation is intended to always answer no.
It's the total assets, but I'll check that.
I'll check
DP.
Yeah.
It's credited as well.
Okay, so that was the easy bit. Now, Kumar, you're doing derivatives?
Yep, coming to derivatives after having gone through... Okay, can I just bring you all to slide 29, please? And derivatives was where it's derivatives on own equity. Firstly, that's what we are looking at, not the other derivatives, what we're talking about. And one of the things that's come up, and it's primarily this is the section where we have tried to keep things as much as possible, including compounds and other things, and I'll come to some of the contingent features that we have spoken about. But one of the things that from history we know is that with IAS 32, the biggest question is what does fixed mean, fixed for fixed? It's easy to articulate, but very difficult at times when things become complex. What do you mean by fixed? So if I have a dilution which is coming just because I'm diluting, I'm issuing more shares, does it violate the fixed for fixed requirement? If I have done a rights issue or some other thing that I'm handling, does it violate the fixed for fixed? So what we have tried to do when we look at the definitions for derivatives and how we've tried to do it is to address these challenges, and that's why there's a slight deviation. We still use the same concepts of timing and amount, but we bring in the variables because that's the only way we could think of how we address some of these challenges. And, of course, there are certain inconsistencies in the accounting that is there in 32 because of the exceptions and some of the plugins that we have put in over time that have been put in. And we have tried to address those. So if I look at slide 30, it talks about the same concepts which Sue spoke about, the amount and timing. And it looks at the net amount. And basically, it says if it's net cash settled, you're a liability because you have an obligation to pay cash. And I'll come to your question, Chris, when we come to whether this is net share settled because it's not an economic resources. And that's a big change from 32 where these will be equity under the thing. And the net amount of a derivative is affected by a variable that is independent of the entity's available economic resources. So it's the same concept of amount, but we are looking at a variable that is affecting the net amount because these are driven by variables. And if I go to slide 31, that's where I look at some of the examples of the variables and where did we pick these up from. It's basically based from practice. What are the issues that have come up in practice, which is one is contingent exercise, which are COCOs, which is beyond the control or not. Special financial measures, example, EBIT, if it changes because of EBIT. Dividends, foreign currency, and anti-dilution. And what the DP then goes and does is it looks into each of these variables and says when and when it doesn't violate the amount feature and when you get the equity or liability classification. And before I speak about that, let me just quickly go through some examples which hopefully brings this to light. And I'm on slide number 32, where an entity has the option to sell 5 shares for CU500, and they're physically settled, i.e., on the date of settlement, you will hand over 5 shares and get 100. There's no other settlement mechanism. So if you look at it, is the net amount creates an obligation to transfer cash? No. Is the amount impacted by any variable other than own share price? Clearly no. So what you're going to do is that for both questions you have ticked, and this becomes an equity instrument, as is the case under 32. This is the classic example of a fixed for fixed derivative for own shares. Moving on to slide number 33, which is just the same thing, but here it is net cash settled. So whether it will only be exercised because you have written the option when you are going to lose money, and you will have an obligation to transfer cash. And very clearly, in this case, even though it is affected by only share price, you have an obligation to transfer cash. So you will end up being a liability, a derivative liability here. And the last example is the one which I was mentioning to Chris, is where the change comes in, is here I have something which is possible, which is net share settled. So on that day, assuming the share price is CU25, because you're going to give 5 shares and get 100 back, the difference is 125 minus 100, which is the value of one share. And what you will do is we'll settle this by giving one share or transferring one share. And since this is net share settled, which is not an economic resource, which is the transfer of the entity as in the DP, this will be equity classified. And this is a big change from 32. Because under 32, net share settled also ends up being liability classified. So this is a big change which we are moving. And because of the reasons you were alluding to, Chris, this is where we end up of the implication when we look at shares, and that's not the economic resources of the entity.
Thank you, Mark. Example 5, that's a purchased option to sell.
Yes.
That's a purchase put.
Yeah, well, a purchase, not a written.
There isn't actually an obligation on the entity as such.
Yeah. Sold.
Sold. Option.
Written option.
Yeah. Well, sorry, the main difference between the example 5 and example 6 is just the 5 is cash settled.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's a huge
difference. Yeah. Net share settled and everything. Sorry, yes. An option. Yeah. Net share settled and net cash settled, Alessandro.
That doesn't make that difference. It's cash settled.
You have an obligation to transfer cash.
For a large public company, it's really. From an economic perspective, this is fixed for fixed.
But cash settled.
Cash settled.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But it'll be a liability under 32 as well.
It'll be a liability under 32 as well.
So if you think about what I was going on and on about, the timing amount, have I got an obligation to write a check? The answer is yes. So this is consistent with the model.
I just mean that if you have shares in your treasury, own shares in your treasury, that's economically distinguishable. If you cash with the share that you already have.
If you have, it's exactly a net share settled.
Yeah, it's exactly the same transaction.
That's a claim for cash.
But the other is a claim for cash.
My own shares, my treasury is pretty much cash.
Well, it depends. I don't think every company in the world will say that my treasury shares are equivalent to cash.
Of course, not all.
I think that's a different model, Alessandro.
That's a very different model, Alessandro. I think that a lot of people have gone the other way.
Not all circumstances, not all amounts, not all companies, but.
And all circumstances. It's very clearly dependent upon the circumstances of what is happening.
I think the key difference between what we've got in 32 and what's proposed here for these own share derivatives is it links with the overall model. So do I have to write a check? Is the amount of the obligation moving with my performance? And so we're asking the same test for derivatives as for other instruments, which is different to 32 today, where sort of out of nowhere this fixed for fixed thing pops up. And then we have all of these challenges with the whys. So by building on the same basic idea, we hope to make the model more complete
and consistent.
And you'll see when, you know, Kumar said when he was introducing slide 31, he said, you know, and we explain how you deal with each of these, not just more words around it. It takes each of these situations and analyzes them against the core principles. So these are the most typical, but it's walking through and looking at how you apply the model to analyze these, which hopefully will give it, you know, Alessandra, to your very original point, some longer duration as a model, because it addresses not just these most typical, but says, here's how you analyze features under the model.
Can I just clarify then? So is it really share settled, or is it something that's actually equity classified? Sorry, if you do have something else that's actually not a share that just still meets your definition of equity settled, is that going to still...
So you are saying I have an instrument which is, when we say net share settled, it's net equity settled. It's an instrument that meets a definition of an equity. We haven't explored it in the DP and such. We couldn't think of one. But I would generally say, yes, it's an equity.
It
meets a definition.
If it was settled, say, I don't know, in preference shares that were equity classified, you'd be able to say there's no obligation to transfer economic resources. So if the amount was moving with the... you know, in a way that's not independent, then yes, I think in theory. Yeah, but it would depend on how that amount feature works.
How the amount feature, and you're saying you're still settling with an equity instrument, which is not an economic resource.
So it changes if you are settled at on preference shares that are liabilities.
Yes, then it doesn't.
If the preference share is classified as equity.
As a liability, so that instrument
liability.
For the amount feature, when you're looking just at the amount feature, because the amount feature is, can you be required to transfer cash or other economic resources? So if what you're required to transfer is own equity, and I mean, I'm looking at Kumar as I amplify, but for the amount feature, you're okay. But sorry, you should have all beat me up. For the... timing feature, you're okay. For the amount, you have to look at how you determine what the amount is. And the fact that you're okay for timing doesn't carry over to amount.
Well, doesn't it also apply to timing? Because again, if your definition is economic resources, which is other than your own instruments, which has to be your equity classified ones, I would have thought you'd have to apply to both tests.
If it's in your example, if it's settled in the form of something which itself is equity, then yes, it's not an obligation to deliver economic resources. So that test is okay. So then it's all about what's the value of that amount on settlement.
So what you're saying, Chris, is just preference shares instead of shares, but they still meet equity. Okay, going on to why are we looking at the variables, because these are the questions which we got quite a bit in IFRIC on dilution, anti-dilution, and I won't go through all of this. The DP deals with this in quite a bit of detail where it says which conditions meet and why it doesn't, because one of the things is that if you look at it, if you're sharing in the distribution of the available economic resources, which is in the share price, which is being distributed through dilution equally, then that shouldn't be a reason for you to flip into a liability classification. The only other bit, which I don't think we covered in detail, which is I would like to mention, is that foreign currency, the exception which is there, is being proposed to be removed, but with a separate presentation for foreign currency, which Mary will cover.
And that's why. So if I issue shares and the amount that I'm going to receive is variable because of foreign currency fluctuations.
I'm talking about a derivative instrument only.
So the net amount will change because of the
foreign
change
currency.
In the FX, the currency exchange rate, and your own share price. So because it's not just being driven by my share price.
Yes.
It wouldn't meet the definition of equity for a derivative in the DP.
Andreas, if you're thinking about the current foreign currency rights exception, remember that's for a right to acquire shares, not for...
A right to issue shares.
Issue shares.
To issue shares.
It's a derivative.
Okay.
That's the only one. So effectively, the net amount is being impacted not just by your share price, but by a foreign currency variable.
Yeah.
And that foreign currency variable, we cannot say is dependent on the entity's available economic resources, because it's completely independent. That's a reasoning.
So the derivative test is quite tough in the discussion paper, I think, to be honest, because it says if there's any variability in the value of that amount on settlement that's driven by something other than your own share price or the time value of money, it doesn't meet the definition. It doesn't meet that amount test.
That's the reason, Andres. But it does come in with separate presentation, because remember, this not only kicks in for the rights issues also, but it becomes very critical for foreign currency convertible bonds.
Sure.
That's where the other, because for the currency option, when you split it out, the same test applies and equally. So that's the reason why it's been done. But look, yes, so that's the other change. So in slide 36, we ask the basic questions about net cash settled, net amount of the derivative, and the other question which is there, which is, if you look at 36A, a derivative on own equity would be classified in its entirety as an equity instrument, a financial asset, or a financial liability. Now, there is a section on the DP, in the DP which looks at those of you who have been around, and also I'm showing my age, of reassessed expected outcomes, or whether we should split derivatives or not, and effectively it says no. So what you're doing is looking at the derivative instrument as a whole. Now, let me make one point clear. We are looking at the derivative as a whole. A hybrid will have a derivative, a hybrid or a compound instrument has a host plus an embedded. You split that. What we are talking about is don't further go and split the derivative. So that's the important distinction I want to make. And there is a question which we ask in the DP on whether we should explore that or not. As of now in the DP, the board has clearly said that's not something we are willing to consider unless and until we hear otherwise. Okay. Going on to compound instruments and redemption obligation arrangements. It's slide number 38. Now, frankly speaking, this is where I think we have changed the least, other than adding on a few bolt-ons to achieve consistency between the accounting parts, because I don't think we have make any changes to the accounting for compounds or puts, NCI puts and other things, other than giving the explanations behind why the accounting is being driven and what is the accounting, with quite a few examples, worked out examples in the DP of how the accounting should work. And this is where I come to, where I spoke about an embedded derivative or a standalone derivative. You should get consistent accounting. There should be no arbitrage between embedding something in a compound or a hybrid instrument and doing a standalone. So that's the whole compound instrument guidance that we have. Exercise conditional at the option of the holder and conditional depending upon uncertain future events. Alessandro, this is what we discussed. This is a section you will get the full discussion on, where we have said that for the purposes of the classification, if the holder doesn't have the ability, then it doesn't work. And last, extinguishing what we call redemption obligations or the portable accounting. Now, slide 39 gives the accounting concepts at a pretty high level, and the DP then delves much more into detail. So if you look at the first part, is the convertible bond, which we are very familiar with the accounting, that you have a host and then you have the conversion option. And you take that conversion option through the same derivatives test to determine whether it's a liability or an equity instrument. The similar, I don't want to use fixed for fixed, but what we have spoken about, the net amount and the whether you have an obligation to deliver cash. The bit that's changed is basically when we look at redemption obligations, I wouldn't say change, which has got an add-on to it, other puts on own shares, written put options. What it does continue the accounting forward. You gross up, and when it comes to NCI puts, which has been quite a big area and one of the reasons why it came back, if we said the board, if you look at the DP, we cover in detail, and I've got the paragraph numbers, is 5.39, and the whole section 5.27, it covers in detail of what will be the accounting for NCI puts. You de-recognize what happens when the option expires without being exercised, how you put it back, and we go through in detail, and we ask questions on this one, because what do you think about the accounting? The part I would like to draw attention to is that even when I recognize a liability for the written put, what today, and there is, to be fair, diversity in practice on how people do this. Some people will just recognize the liability. Others will recognize an optionality component, which is there, still there, even if I recognize the liability, unless the liability is at fair value. So what the DP explores in quite a bit of detail is what is this accounting and how do we complete the accounting? It doesn't change the NCI put recognition, but it asks the question is that this is the bit which is being missing. This is the accounting could be potentially missing. I cannot say is missing under the current thing. What should people do and what are the questions we ask on how that should be done? And again, we work through, go through worked examples of this one. So I would say from a perspective, attention perspective of where you could think of looking at is the puts, because the compounds hasn't changed much other than the foreign currency bit, which I spoke about, which applies consistently across. It's for the written puts where we look at the equity component and the written option component separately. So slide 40 actually recaps what I've said is IAS 32 required the gross-up in that famous paragraph. We have given the explanation of why you need to gross-up, because you have an obligation to pay that amount, and that's the gross amount. We have gone into details of how that liability will unwind and what is the balance requirement of the accounting, which some people are doing. We have got into quite a bit of detail about NCI puts, because that's where the issues come in. You de-recognize the non-controlling. What do you do when the option expires? Is exercised when it is not? All of that we go through in detail. And effectively, it says you de-recognize the NCI if when you recognize the liability, because that's what's happening. If it's it expires unexercised, you re-recognize the NCI. And we ask a question on that. The other thing is, where again Mary will come in, is that because some of these options are putable at fair value, so you have an obligation to pay cash, but the amount feature, as you were talking, Kimberly, is completely linked to share price. There is a separate presentation requirement, because we do have the same issue, which we have, is that the better you do, the worse your performance looks, and vice versa. So that's what, again, Sue was saying, it links into some of these concepts, which Mary will talk about when we go into Section 7. And this is what are the questions. Slide 41 and 42 cover the questions in the DP. Now, in slide 42, we have covered a question, which is I haven't covered in detail in the slides, and I'm happy to take a question, is that as of now today, IAS 32 is a bit silent on whether you have an equity host. Mm. Haven't seen that much instruments with that. And we were unsure whether there is anything of a problem there that needs to be solved or what we need to do. So this is specifically covered, and there's a question asked in the DP, do you think we should progress along the lines to require separation from an equity host? Some instruments, you have the equity host, where the conversion feature might become a liability. That's the question in slide 42, 41, as the general questions and compounds.
Andreas?
Are you planning to address the measurement question for that newborn financial liability then in IFRS 9 or at a later stage? Because currently you classify under IFRS 9 and measure them either at amortized cost, which I would assume in this case it doesn't really apply, and fair value really depends on how these NCI written puts are then being settled. So if they're fair value is settled, I think you probably go to fair value measurement. But if there is a different exercise price, how do you measure them? So is there not a missing link in 9? Because 9 is binary on the measurement. It either is fair value through P&L or amortized cost. Amortized cost here doesn't make any sense.
Yes, you're right. Let's look at the fair value.
Yep.
Andres. There, because your liability is picking up the entire fair value movement,
right,
there's nothing else to measure.
Right.
So that will be under 9, whatever happens. And the difference, what I was speaking about from the 9, is the separate presentation,
right,
which Mary will speak about. You have a fixed price put. Let's say there's something which you're doing. Then that's a fixed amount. There's nothing to remeasure.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you still have an option mm-hmm. in there where you can that thing. You don't exercise, what happens? You have the right to extinguish it. We cover it in detail, what you will do if that option meets the conditions for this, then it might even be equity classified. Mm-hmm. If not, it'll be a derivative, but we cover that in detail.
But it might still be an exercise that's somewhere between a fixed amount and fair value. Could be a formula, could be all sorts of things. So a multiple on God knows what, earnings of the previous parent company, I don't know.
So really your question is, if you end up with a liability classification for a put that's other at fair value, does it make sense to jam it into the classification requirements that we have in IFRS 9, classifications that we have in IFRS 9, or should we be creating a new measurement, a new classification and therefore measurement requirement for this instrument?
Under 9, though, just to clarify that we're on the same page, I think you'd end up having the choice to bifurcate it, because it's a liability site, to bifurcate it or to use the fair value option.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. So it's the bifurcation we look at.
Okay.
So think of it, Andres, this will become a hybrid or a compound. I'm not saying either way.
Okay.
And then the guidance kicks in like anything else. That's when but that is covered.
Okay.
That is covered. It's either be a hybrid where you have a liability embedded or a compound where you have an equity embedded. Okay. And that we do cover. But yes, that does kick in.
Yukio.
Yukio.
Thank you. Question slide 40. The proposed approach.
Sorry, Yukio. Couldn't hear you.
40.
Yeah. Sorry. Slide 40. The proposed approach justifies a gross presentation of a region put option, owing to the similarity of a region put option to convertible bond. My question is whether a return put option that is cash settled should be presented net under the proposed approach in the same manner as under IAS 32.
So you're saying it's a...
Under IAS 32, a return put option would be presented gross if it is settled net gross, and would be presented net if it is net settled. So my question is that, you know, the manner would be applied to your proposed approach.
Proposal. If it's net cash settled, are you saying then it is just a derivative instrument on own equity, which does not meet...
Yes, yes.
...with the liability classification with that?
Written put option. Written put option on the entities, you know, the own share.
So you would still have an obligation to pay the amount of the cash, wouldn't you, Yukio? But it would be just the net amount.
Net amount, yeah.
If it was just a derivative where... you didn't return the actual shares, but just a derivative that I've written where I'm going to pay an amount based on my shares, so it's a cash-settled version of a put, then it would just be a liability. It wouldn't be grossed up. Mm-hmm. The gross-up requirements apply either to instruments where a fixed number of shares come back and you have to pay cash for them, or if it's net physically settled, but not if it's net cash-settled.
It will be a derivative liability. I'm assuming it doesn't meet... the equity conditions, you will mark it through P&L, but again, then the separate presentation might come in, but it would be a derivative liability as of today.
So, equity swap.
If it's just cash, then it would be just a liability mark to market.
But if it's
fixed shares for variable shares, like a net share, then it would be grossed up as well, which is a difference from 32.
Yeah.
But it's a swap based on my own equity that I sell in cash.
That will be gross.
That will be gross.
I think one thing we're planning to do is, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, was in 32 there was illustrative examples in the appendix which showed all of the different types of derivatives and how the accounting worked. I think we're planning to do a summary that will go through all of the different types and then map them to the requirements in the DP, because it's quite... there's so many different variants. I think it will aid understanding. Certainly when I did the exercise, it helped me.
Andrew? Slide 42 mentions reverse convertible bonds. Yeah. So just comparing and contrasting to IAS 32, I think under 32 you'd need to compare the value of the equity settlement outcome to the value of the cash settlement outcome. If the value of the equity settlement outcome significantly exceeds, might not have the right words, but significantly exceeds the cash settlement outcome, you conclude it's not substantive. Is it the same under the preferred model, or?
Yes.
It is.
We haven't changed that, Andrew. Yeah. Yes. You're looking at the settlement. It's important, a good point as you come in, not only but that's where it kicks in, where yep. you, whether you might have an equity host or not. That's where it is. What do you do with the other settlement outcome? That's a question we ask.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
It's over to me for presentation to start with, and I'm afraid I worry that I'm going to fail Sue's publicly stated expectation of referring back to the earlier slide, so I'm going to count on her to jump in and make the connection when I forget to. If it were later in the day, I'd say, you know, once you get through Section 5, everybody deserves a drink, because going through some of the analysis, if you really hold on tight and follow it, it to me it comes together, but it's a pretty challenging read, especially chapters 4 and 5. So congratulate yourself when you get to the presentation section. I'm going to start by saying that there are two pieces that get grouped under presentation. Both are very important, but they're different things. One is how you present changes in certain types in the carrying value of certain types of liabilities, and that's when Sue wants me to refer back to those earlier slides. The other presentation issue is an expanded presentation of the statement of changes in shareholders' equity to really show how each class of equity claim participates in comprehensive income for the period. So those are two quite different topics that get lumped in under the topic of presentation. And you might need to top up your drink when you get through the expanded statement of changes in shareholders' equity, because of one of the questions that we're really looking for some input on about different ways of doing that. But let's start with what may be the simpler of the two presentation questions, which is shown on slide 44. And for me, NCI puts are the poster child for this kind of issue. So what we do is we're really identifying, and I will try and live up to Sue's expectations. If you look at slide 22, you know, if you go back, you have the purple box, which is the double liability, because you know it takes both the timing and the amount feature. But if you move to the right-hand side, you have shares that are puttable at fair value. So the amount is behaving as if it were an equity claim. But because you can be required to write a check before liquidation, it gets classified as liability. Well, what we're looking at under our preferred approach is to separate out that type of instrument and present the changes in that type of instrument as OCI. And why are we doing it? Really, as I think Kumar made a comment before when he alluded to the fact that it's this kind of counterintuitive point of the better that, you know, the better that the entity does, so therefore the higher the value at which, for example, the NCI can be put, the greater the amount of claims. So does it make sense as that the entity does better, yet you have this increase affecting the determination of performance in the current period? So our conclusion, our preliminary view under the preferred approach, is that we should separate out this type of change and present it separately in other comprehensive income. Doesn't change the fact that it's still the item still is liability classified, but it's segregating the change in carrying value and presenting it in OCI. Now, when you look at slide 45, you see that after we made that basic conclusion, we went through, in some pretty tortuous board papers and discussions, examination of whether there was anything else that either under the core principles, you know, the two classification criteria, or for other reasons, should be presented separately in OCI. And our conclusion, and I at least characterize it as an exception, is yes, for certain types of foreign currency exercise price. And so that is the additional exception. So what you see on slide 45 is, does the return behave like a return on an equity instrument? In other words, the amount is not in any way independent of the entity's available economic resources. If the answer is yes, you're segregating out the change in that carrying value and presenting it in comprehensive income. If the return, if the amount feature does not behave like an equity instrument, then its changes in carrying value are going into P&L. So, Andreas, question?
Would it be fair to characterize it such that you say you took care of the distortions or potential distortions on performance, but you didn't take care of the distortions for equity? Because the same line of argument that you presented, then applies obviously to the equity section. So the more valuable that liability becomes, the lower the equity, and probably is going to flip to the next.
Yeah, but it is, and I'm going to keep channeling Sue. It is an instrument where somebody can rock up and say, "Pay me the money now. Distribute the available economic resources," and that does not sound like an equity distortion to present the right to come and take away assets of the company.
Depending on the fact whether or not you do have a class of equity holders, right? Other than that. Because you're making an assumption here that obviously you have the exception for the puttables, but if the puttable instruments don't meet that test, then there is no residual class left. So the question is, what is it then?
Well, I'm not sure from your question, and I think I'm looking to be saved by Sue and Kumar on this one. I'm not sure if your question, if you're really asking about the criteria for the puttables exception.
No. It is, if you say that taking care of that distortion in the performance statement is correct, and it is also correct not to touch on the equity section because, as you say, if somebody can demand you paying that person, that claimant, before liquidation, it must be a liability. The question is, what is if you don't have any equity holders then? If you don't have anything? Because the puttables exception only applies, and to be the most residual part is just one of these six conditions there, and it may well be that the puttables don't meet the entire list of the exemption. Then the question is, okay, what then is equity, or is there no equity in that case?
And I think this is an example where we haven't, even though we've talked more about why we get to the classification outcome, we haven't really changed the position that's in 32, which
right.
says if you've got an obligation to write a check, this is a liability, right? So we think because there's an obligation to write a check, even though the movement is aligned with performance, that liability classification is appropriate for the reasons that I went through. But we do acknowledge the fact that this is very different to a normal debt instrument. And so therefore we think it's useful to provide separate information about it so you can clearly see actually this is something different. It's got a different effect on performance, so we'll put it separately in OCI. But we're not walking away from the fact that actually we do think it's a liability, which I think is different to the puttables exception where we've got an extra step for a very specific set of circumstances. And it's a discussion paper, so people can say whether or not they agree with it. But
yeah.
This was quite a difficult discussion at the board table because some of us are quite, there's differences of opinion on whether this should be in other comprehensive income at all, given that it's a liability. The closest analogy we've probably got is to own credit, where we do something very similar, liability classified, but and it's an own and it's an OCI. But the big difference is with own credit, it pulls to par. This doesn't pull to par, right? And we propose not to recycle as well. So we have a situation where you may in fact have to write a check for a big number, and it's going to be an OCI, and it's never going to hit P&L. So it's quite a concession in terms of presentation, actually, but it doesn't go all of the way that you might want to go in terms of aligning to puttables.
Jim?
So I guess the line for own performance here is the same except for the foreign currency?
Yes.
Yes.
So
yes.
I wonder if you'll see a lot of things that in most reasonable scenarios are linked to own performance. We talked about some of those before. So the change is going to be economically driven by own performance in the vast majority of scenarios, but it will fail that test. For example, something that slightly fails a fixed for fixed adjustment in most reasonable scenarios, the value of that instrument is driven by own performance. Mm-hmm. Those will be classified in the P&L, that change in performance, whereas an instrument that had fixed for fixed but failed the cash, its performance would be an OCI. So I think it has the potential to be fairly confusing as to why you're taking own performance through the P&L in some periods or for some instruments, because you're not isolating own performance like you do own credit. All performance is now going to be in two different places, sometimes in OCI and sometimes in the P&L.
That's true, and that's one of the things I wanted to actually bring out with one of the questions on that you see summarized on slide 46, which is we had to make a decision about whether you always split out the own performance component and present that component in OCI, or whether you look at it and you look at an instrument and say, is it a pure, behaving like own equity? And sorry, I'm speaking very loosely here, not in the precise words of the DP. Is it pure own equity, in which case the changes in carrying value are OCI, or is it not pure? And we went back and forth, and I think if you look at that third bullet, the third point, which is a bullet point on slide 46, that's what that question is trying to ask. And there's a real balancing of the complexity of starting to take apart every instrument and bring out the own performance feature versus the fact that you will get some, I'll call it, Andreas called it distortion, I'll call it noise in P&L when something is related in part, and it might even be largely to own performance.
And I guess you'd also have to be much more precise about own performance if you were going to require it to be bifurcated. Yeah. You'd have to answer the question.
But your question's a very good one, and there's a really long section in the DP going through all of the challenges and the alternatives we went through. So again, love your feedback.
Thank you. The DP proposes that the income and the expenses arising from some financial liabilities be presented in OCI separately.
Right.
Would such income and expenses include dividends? In particular, if an ordinary share is part of a redemption obligation arrangement, that is presented separated as a liability in its entirety. Would the dividend paid from such ordinary share give rise to expenses?
I think we might end up with that instrument classified in two parts.
Yes.
In which case the dividend would not be within this treatment.
But if you had...
So can I just understand the instrument, UQ? What is the instrument?
With ordinary dividend flows.
The liability is, shown as a liability that have the equity-like, return.
So you have an instrument that although the amount feature is qualifies it for presentation in OCI,
right.
But it's puttable, so that's right. Why it's liability classified. So therefore, the changes in the carrying value are recognized in OCI.
Yeah.
And then you pay a dividend
right.
On that instrument.
So just a normal ordinary share that's puttable, but it's still got a dividend flow.
Right.
Yeah,
I don't think we address it specifically, but I don't think you'd need to put the dividend with the changes in carrying amount because it's got a different nature to the...
It's a changes in fair value of that liability that will go through OCI, so...
I think that's a compound instrument.
Yeah. You've got another layer in there.
Compound requirements, and then you'd need to look at what was sent to nine and what was kept as equity.
Let's take that question about the dividend. Obviously we're not going to answer it in the DP, but think about how we analyze that question. Chris,
so I guess Just to clarify, so it's not going to be a choice. It has to be, if you meet these criteria, you'll go one way. Because I was sort of thinking about Andreas's point, because we do have a lot of entities in Australia that are actually having just debt instruments and managed investment schemes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am wondering whether that's actually going to be a good outcome, that they're going to have to split bits and pieces.
The splitting Mary was talking about is not splitting the derivatives or anything, it's the embeds. So you have the option today, let's say if you have an embedded, to use the fair value option. So then the question comes up, should the whole thing be in OCI or just the derivative, as Andres and Jim was talking about, which is linked to share price, but just has this foreign currency element be in OCI? That's the question we ask in the discussion paper, because the reason why the question comes up, Chris, is that the fair value option was given to avoid that complication.
I think we might talk offline, because I think it might be a bit more complicated.
But maybe let me step back and go back to my notes, because I kind of jumped to that question when Jim raised his point. I jumped to the third bullet on slide 46. First of all, Chris, to your basic question, if the liability has the characteristic, and I'm going to be, obedient to Sue's instruction to refer back to slide 22. If it has the characteristic of being in the right-hand box where shares putable at fair value, for example, then it's not an option; it's a requirement to present the changes in that amount in OCI. So it's requirement, not permission. But I think what Kumar was going to, in the context in which the board was looking at this third bullet point, is if you have an embedded derivative that would qualify for separate presentation, but it's embedded as part in an instrument to which, let's say, you elect to apply the fair value option. The fair value option requires you to fair value the whole instrument, not just a piece of it. And so then, because you're applying the fair value option to the whole instrument, you're going to have that's an example of an instance in which part of the reason for the change in the fair value of that instrument is changes in the entity's performance. And the question that we wrestled with is, in that circumstance, should we be either permitting or requiring separation of the piece that relates to your own performance or not? And that's where we were looking for input. I'm not sure that answers your question with respect to the particular Australian funds schemes, but I guess I just wanted to be clear that when we were looking at this, we were asking the question that's referred to on the slide in the context of, let's say, an embedded derivative that itself would qualify, but it gets wrapped into this bigger thing, and then we're not pulling out the piece that relates to changes from equity-like performance. Okay. Now, as I said, there are two pieces of...
15 minutes left, Mary.
It's okay. It's okay. The second piece of presentation is an expanded statement of changes in shareholders' equity. And what you see on slide 47 is kind of the step-by-step approach that gets you pretty quickly down to the step three, which is present income and expenses attributable to derivative equity instruments using one of three possible methods. Why three possible methods? We couldn't decide which was less ugly. And this is an instance in which, this is one of the points that I think it would be very helpful to ask you to focus on. It's a big ask, because this is the other place where you may need to top up your drink as you're reading this, because going through this section of the paper can be quite challenging. There are some simple numerical examples that help you see what the different impacts are, and it's worth working through those calculations. A couple of points that I want to make. First of all, this is about attributing comprehensive income. It's not creating additional items of comprehensive income because of independent measurement, you know, direct measurement of equity. It's all about attribution of comprehensive income. Now, we have three approaches. The difference between the full fair value approach and the two average and end of period approach is that the full fair value approach could result in an entity with positive comprehensive income having negative comprehensive income allocated to ordinary shares, because the amount attributed to ordinary shares is the offset of the remeasurement of the derivative instruments. While the two other methods, the average and the end of period, are looking at different ways to allocate assuming that the comprehensive income is positive, to allocate comprehensive income so that you couldn't have less than zero for the ordinary shares there. You could end up attributing all of it to other instruments, but you couldn't end up with less than zero. So that's you know, the big line of demarcation between full fair value and the average and end of period. Both average and end of period are relative fair values. Now, the other thing that I wanted to point out, which is obvious and we point out in the paper, is an average, we think, might give more meaningful representation of the performance in the period, but it involves more calculations of probably non-observable items. So, you know, there's likely to be a higher cost, because if you're doing average, you have to do more than the period end fair value determination. So those are some of the pros and cons that are identified. But this is to try and come back to what we perceived as one of the pressures that drives some users to argue for a very narrow definition of equity, because it's, hey, we get lots more information. You know, it may not be perfect, but we get more information about things that are liability classified than equity classified. And one of the things that we really want is information about participation, because participation is not always level. And so the expanded statement of changes in shareholders' equity is a way of responding to that information about what is the participation, you know, who within equity are the winners and losers in the period. So that's what we're trying to do with the second piece of presentation. So then we get to the questions that we ask in the DP on slide 49. Okay, Sue, you came up before Andreas, so.
I just wanted to make the point that this is perhaps the boldest proposal that's in the discussion paper from my perspective, because it's quite a big change. I'll give you equity classification for some derivatives, but I give you with one hand and I sort of require something with the other. And so I think the entry-level question as well, and it will be really important for you, if we could get some help from you to get feedback from the users of financial statements, because I think we really need to understand what the benefits are from their perspective for the extra cost from a preparer perspective. And one of the entry-level questions is this a good idea? If it is, which of the three is the better idea? But also, would it be enough just to improve disclosures? So would it be enough to start getting information on the fair value of equity derivatives, which we don't have today? And so that's one of the questions we ask as well.
Andreas?
Would it be fair to say that none of these three approaches actually shows you the full dilutive effect on ordinary shares? Because I try to akin this to the prior proposal that was in the discussion paper on the conceptual framework, where we also had a reattribution of certain value changes between ordinary shareholders and the rest that was measured against that. So is this similar? And in that case, it wasn't the full dilution either, because you don't remeasure everything, you just remeasure part of the instruments.
I think the fair value, the first approach, probably comes closest, but...
But that has a time value effect, right? So it's not just intrinsic value. If you say fair value, right?
Yeah.
Volatility value could change, time value change.
Yeah.
Maybe nothing to do with earnings.
Mm-hmm.
Andres, absolutely, because one of the things when we're talking about this, this is for derivatives only. The other parts, which are non-derivative equity, it's still under 33, so there's no way it will be full dilutive what you're talking about. It's looking at, and why is also, because that's the request that came in, but equity, we understand, it's for derivatives and these complex weather information content. So the focus is there. And yes, it's time value and intrinsic. It's not intrinsic. If you look at dilution in terms of intrinsic value, only how many shares, if you're not putting the probability of exercise and seeing what is the maximum dilution as best, so fair value captures it. And there are different methods of doing it, or disclosure.
So is there, may there also be a third variant, rather than going to one of these attribution approaches or provide disclosure only, is do the same attribution for instruments? Would that be another one? Because as you say, you distinguish now between the derivatives and the cash instruments.
Non-derivative equity instruments.
Exactly.
One of the things we do discuss about, and when we say disclosure, we don't go into, is that use 33 and see what you think. So yes, obviously, that's...
And moving on to disclosure, which we cover in Section 7, I'm probably going to give it short shrift today, but it does deserve more. Consistent feedback we hear is not enough information provided to users, in their perspective, about the terms and conditions, and also a very strong desire to get all the information in one place so that they don't have to go hunting through a document to get a good perspective on the total claims for the entity. And so, as Sue said, one of the questions we had in the previous presentations section is disclosure, the alternative to attribution. But even if it's not, we still have to look at disclosure and disclosure proposals.
So. These disclosures, though, I think make perfect sense if you apply them to an individual entity.
Mm-hmm.
I have difficulty in understanding how this works in a group context because you don't depict seniority within a group. I mean, not just by a tabular format. You probably need something more than that. I would assume.
Okay. I'm cautious about getting into starting to talk about the merits of it, and I do want to make sure we cover a couple of things in the contractual section, especially since some of them relate back to Patrick's question at the very beginning of the section. Alessandro, would you mind if I just went through Section 8 and then we came back with what time we have? Contractual terms, and I think personally one of the most important is economic compulsion, and I think, Andrew, you raised this question before. The basic model, and we talked about this before, is does the issuer have an unavoidable, which means not within the entity's control, obligation to transfer economic resources. The question that we looked at in economic compulsion that we revisited, it's addressed in IS 32, we revisited again, is should there be an overlay to that, this is my expression of it, based on either intent, likelihood, or both? And likelihood especially is economic compulsion, which could be anywhere from economic incentive to compulsion. And in the end, having worked through that in some detail, what we say in the discussion paper is we want to stay where we are, which is that if the terms and conditions of the instrument, and this is the terms and conditions of the instrument, mean that it is structurally always in the money, you have an indirect obligation, and you have to recognize that indirect obligation in the classification in measurement. Okay, but if it is not structural, then it's not an implicit requirement to transfer, and therefore you do not consider economic incentives. So you don't have an intent or likelihood, so probability, none of that comes into the classification. So that's, I direct your attention to 8.23. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention in connection with this is that we do think that some of the pressure in the area of economic compulsion will be reduced because of the way the amount feature works. And in that respect, and I did write in my cheat sheet, look back, and I think, Chris, you may have been the person at the beginning who was looking at the examples in Section 3 and Paragraph 23. And the example analyzing, I think it's the cumulative pref shares. It's the step so that you can waive payment of a dividend. But if so, there's a step up in the rate. And the way that you analyze that instrument under the timing and amount, the amount feature causes that instrument to be liability classified. And that was always the example that people held up when they were looking at economic compulsion. So I think that in some ways the amount feature analysis will reduce some of the pressure on economic compulsion, and that's partly what the board was thinking when we came to the conclusion to keep the status quo. Now, the other thing that's covered in this section is on 56, so I have to squint, contract and law. We had a specific consideration about whether we look only at the terms of the contract or whether we also integrate into the analysis regulation and law. And our conclusion was to stick with the terms of the contract. As a result, we decided to keep IFRIC 2 as what I think will be in the context of this discussion paper an exception to that, but keep it isolated to that. So that, Patrick, when you asked the question this morning about the interaction that under certain conditions, let's say, you may not have to pay or you may not be allowed to pay a distribution on an instrument. The two questions I'd ask is that a term and condition of the instrument, or is it a term, or is it an external regulation? That's the thing that you would have to think about in terms of analyzing.
In fact, I was referring to the variable capital.
Okay.
Variable capital, whereby, and this is common in insurance companies or banks, mutual banks, etc., where you have people that subscribe to shares, but they have the right to go at a point in time. So you reduce the equity of the company. So would that be an equity or would that be a liability? So it's not a restriction on the payment of dividends. It is the capital per se.
Well, it sounds like it may be fitting into that IFRIC 2 cooperatives. That's a question. And so what we say in the discussion paper is, having considered, and reached the general conclusion that we're going to remain focused on the contract, we're going to keep we are proposing to keep IFRIC 2 for cooperatives as an exception in this model. Okay.
Need to look at
Hans, I think
we've... or
exactly. I think feedback I received here, it's discussion paper should be more explicit in requiring more exhaustive disclosures about the contractual terms of those instruments. The problem is terminology. So people call different things the same name in different jurisdictions. So what is a preferred share is a completely different animal depending on the jurisdiction. So
less about the label and more about the terms and conditions.
Yeah, qualitative disclosure said this instrument, forget about the name, or you call that, because preference shares in the U.S. completely different from preference shares in Brazil, for example. It's a different animal. And to do these instruments pay that and that and that, how do you work? So to be more precise on the qualitative aspect of those, because then people can judge about the different users have different needs, so it's you see some of the disclosures. I look at some of them and say, "Oh, this is a preferred share that pays that." What a preferred share means depends on where you are, and so
yeah. And really, slide 51 just tells you at a high level what we're talking about requiring. But I think getting that kind of feedback in terms of it doesn't matter about the labels. Here are the things that users need.
Contractual terms. What is this instrument? What really, really entitles the holder to, etc.
Patrick?
It's a very general question, so yeah. I was keeping it for the end.
Okay. Well, Kimberly, there first. Yeah.
Mine's kind of a general question.
I can.
Yeah.
I was asking myself if some sort of impact assessment will be conducted, because I am asking myself how much at global level. equity will be transformed into a liability or the other way around. I think that we will be more on the restrictive side, i.e. we will limit the amount of equity, I think. But I would like to know how much, to a certain extent, we're talking about. Because in terms of financial stability, I think it's a very important feature.
I think that's something we'll want to understand as we get feedback. My sense is that most things, classifications won't change, but we need to confirm that as we talk to people about their instruments, I think, through the exposure process. I think we need to think about that.
And I think we've indicated as we've gone along today at least one instance of, you know, switching either way. Some things that now would be liability classified that become equity classified, and some things that today are equity classified that would become liability. And you know, it could be frequency of instruments, could be amounts. You know, when you look at what the effect is.
Kimberly.
My question is about the link between this project and the conceptual framework, because all through the conceptual framework, people keep saying, why aren't you doing anything on concepts on debt equity? And the answer is, don't worry, we're doing it in this project. And yet when I look at Appendix B, it's rather vague as to, shall I say, as to what the board's plans are once you get to the end of this project. Will you take the principles, not the detailed application rules or guidance, the principles that you come up with, the distinction between debt and equity, and go back and work that into the conceptual framework? Because that was always the expectation and the promise we had.
Yeah. No, fair question, Kimberly, and I agree. We've tried to be open as much, because I really don't know what will be the end of this project look like. So coming back to Patrick's question of impact, yes, when we start getting the things, one of the things we are starting with the assumption, Patrick, that we are not moving things around, but that needs to get confirmed through the outreach process. Also, as we said, one of the things I always remind myself, we are playing to old rules. New rules will come up when this thing comes into play, and new structures and other things will come. But certainly, as we go through that, that is something we will look into for the impact side. As we come near this, as we say in that, certainly if this model gets finalized in some shape or form, post finalization and into a standard, assuming we look that far, then obviously the board will consider the interaction with the concepts and how we deal with it in the conceptual framework going forward.
But you're not going to consider it while you're working on this project?
Not until we have a better firm grip of what the model looks like, because that will be far too open for the concepts, because that's a finalized standard.
Yeah, you know, my personal expectation, and this is truly absolutely me speaking alone, is I don't think we'd regard it as consequential amendments, you know, tidying up to the conceptual framework. But I think we have to have a much better sense, as Kumar said, of where we're going to land, how far we're going to go, before we start thinking about the interaction. I mean, to me, the biggest stress point is the discussion about no practical ability to avoid in terms of the liability description, with the conclusion about economic compulsion. But I don't want to start getting into a whole nother, personally, I'd advise not starting a whole nother, you know, set of moving pieces until we know, have a better sense of where we're going forward. But I think it would be more than, more than consequential amendments tidying up, but how much would have to be imported?
Yeah, and I guess that's what's leading me to ask that question, because when you compare that at a principle level, the principles you've come up with at the moment to what's sitting in the framework, there are clearly differences, not just the one that you mentioned, the economic compulsion idea. There's also the amount idea, which is also different. And
but that's there with 32 as well.
Yeah, I know. And so, you know, we talked about the conceptual framework project, that the liability definition does two things. It determines, do I have a claim at all, which is what the conceptual framework project looked at, and then if I have got a claim, is it debt or equity? So
one is whether you have a claim. That's the CF side you're saying.
Yeah, well, the conceptual framework focused on that piece of it, so IS37 type questions, if you like, do I have a claim at all? And then the second question is, if I have got a claim, is it debt or equity? So at the moment, the liability definition serves two purposes. The conceptual framework project. So we're only going to look at the first one, because the second one is going to come up in this project. Well, I guess the concern is if you don't think about it early enough, you could get to the end of the project and say, we've come up with these principles, now how does that fit with the conceptual framework? I don't know how it fits, and then will we have an indefinite period?
Yeah. But I don't think we're saying that we're going to wait until we finish the FICE project. I think rather, well, first of all, we need to get feedback from people on the first question in the DP. Yeah. Is it worth even working on this? Are the problems worth standard setting? And if so, sort of how much of it is worth working on? People might say, only do presentation and disclosure, don't rework the, you know, classification. And I think we need to look at that and see what feedback we get and then work out what to do. Because I think the bit that we sort of tiptoed around in the conceptual framework was the own share bit. Is it an economic resource or not? And that's where we've got the interaction with this amount concept. And I think we need to see what feedback we get on that to see if we've got something that we want to work on and then how, if and how we should reflect it in the framework.
So in the ED phase, you will start thinking about
it? I think it's too early to say.
Too early.
Until we see what the feedback is.
If it's just disclosure and presentation, then that's a different ballgame completely. It's too early.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess, well, I sort of put, you know, that there is the concern that you will, because you're saying, I'm not going to do this till I've got a concrete, and then you spend 5 years getting a concrete, and then you say, actually, it's different and we can't align it.
But let's finalise what we are going to do at least. So, primarily, we'll have to see. It's a bit early, Kimberly.
But point noted about not to relegate it to the very end.
Not towards the final end. That's what you're saying. Don't keep it pending. No, that's a fair point.
Chris, and then we're going to take a break.
Yeah, so it's along those same lines, certainly some concerns. And I would have thought even just a preliminary look at whether or not what you've got, how it actually ties in with the new conceptual framework. So, for example, don't just think it's Mary's point. The other one I was thinking about is when you're talking about contracts or whether you're going to include statute, the new CF is very clear that liabilities can come from statute or contractual. So if that's the case, then I think you've got to have a fairly good reason to not be bringing up and including some of those statutory obligations that are going to impact people regardless of whether they've got a contract that says something. Think about it early.
Okay. That was a good start for a Monday morning. let's have a break till 5 to 12.